Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. North Korea destroyed the tower of its plutonium-producing reactor today. The U.S. now says it will remove the country from its list of state sponsors of terrorism. Zimbabwe holds an internationally condemned election with only strongman Robert Mugabe still in place. And the U.S. military says an unexpected sandstorm in Anbar is all that's delaying the first handover of a Sunni Arab province to Iraqi control. Joining me for the Friday News Roundup, Michael Hirsch of Newsweek, Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers, and David Ignatius of The Washington Post. And throughout the hour, do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Diane.
On the news at 11 o'clock, we heard an explosion that apparently took place in North Korea as a tower was demolished. Tell us what this is all about, David.
Diane, this was the destruction of a cooling tower at the North Korean reactor at Yongbyon, which has been the center of our focus, our intelligence efforts for many years. And this was in fulfillment of the agreement, the negotiating process for, in theory, holding North Korea to account for its nuclear program. The North Koreans this week delivered a statement about their nuclear activities, which, by everybody's account, did not meet our demands or expectations. But even so, the Bush administration decided to accept it and has moved to take North Korea off its list of terrorist nations, to bring it into, you could say, the community of nations, to normalize our relations. I think we'll soon see, you know, the opening of diplomatic relations between us and North Korea. I wouldn't be surprised if Secretary of State Rice paid a visit to Pyongyang. Conservatives in the administration and outside are furious because they say that we have let North Korea off the hook. Here's a country that not only had a nuclear program, but tested a nuclear weapon in defiance of the international community, and we have essentially cut them a special deal. There is nothing in this agreement that deals with, you know, North Korean bombs, how many, North Korean nuclear material. That's all to be negotiated in the future. So conservatives say this isn't half a loaf. This is, you know, this is a fraction of a loaf.
But despite what the conservative opposition is saying, Nancy, why did the North Koreans decide to do this now?
Well, I think they saw an opportunity to repair relations with the U.S. It's what's interesting is why the Bush administration did it. Was this an effort to leave the administration with some sense of accomplishment of reaching a negotiation? It's an interesting time that in a negotiation that is interestingly prompted criticism that Bush has negotiated too much, which is something we haven't heard for the last 8 years. So it really sort of says, I think, a lot about where the Bush administration is and the efforts to the thought behind its legacy.
So, Michael.
Yeah. I mean, it is complete a remarkable cycle of policy reversals going back to the early months of the Bush administration in 2001, when Colin Powell came out of a briefing with Madeleine Albright and his predecessors in the Clinton administration and said he liked some of their ideas, and he was promptly slapped down. North Korea became part of the Axis of Evil. It began a long period of non-negotiation. And then in the last year and a half or so, basically in the 20 months since North Korea went ahead with its plutonium program and actually detonated a small nuclear device, Chris Hill, who is a longtime pragmatist, helped negotiate Dayton with the Bosnians in the 90s, came up and said, look, I can cut a deal on a bilateral basis. And simply because I think the Bush people were somewhat exhausted over the Middle East issues, Iraq, they said, go ahead, and he did. And in fact, this may be not only the most signal diplomatic achievement of the Bush administration, setting aside Libya, which was mainly negotiated by the British, but it marks a return to what the Clintonites were effectively doing in the 90s.
So what are the risks to dictator Kim Jong-il on this?
Well, right now the risks are you know limited. They're zero. The question is the North Korean military comfortable with the deal that they've made? Will they continue doing activities in secret? One interesting and disturbing aspect of the deal that we've made is that the North Koreans have refused to disclose the extent of their sharing of nuclear technology with nations, including, we believe, Syria. The North Koreans, we think, the CIA director Michael Hayden has presented intelligence reports to Congress demonstrating that the North Koreans helped Syria build a nuclear reactor as part of a secret nuclear program. None of that is disclosed. I would just note one thing, Diane, about this agreement. The Bush administration initially really had no clear policy about North Korea. They cut off the process of engagement that was going on, the agreed framework talks. But they sort of spun their wheels for a while. And then President Bush himself, I think, decided that working with China in the six-party talks, you know, finding a multilateral approach to North Korea made sense. He decided that we could bring China and Japan, our two key partners in the region, together, and that was the best way to deal with North Korea. And it's really that approach, which they continued with, that's finally today yielded this fruit.
You know, we saw the conflict within the administration about this agreement. No sooner than they announced it, they talked about the human rights violations, how this was just one step of a long process, that a lot of issues needed to be dealt with. The Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, was talking about the very issue that you raised, that there's no way to confirm what they're doing or what they're not doing. And interestingly, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, when the announcement was made, said that the agreement would the decision to take them off the terrorist watch list would have no practical effect on anything, which is very interesting.
It's important to note, though, that this is really a triumph of bilateralism. The multilateral process, the six-party talks were not really getting anywhere. China was taking the lead. This resulted from a meeting in Berlin, a quiet meeting that Chris Hill had with North Korean representatives, in which they began for the first time to negotiate head-to-head, which is what Kim Jong-il has always wanted. Remember, our two nations are still officially at war. So it's a combination of things, but the change here, what made this happen, was the willingness finally to engage on a bilateral basis.
Michael Hershey, senior editor at Newsweek, author of the book titled At War With Ourselves. Nancy Youssef, she is Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. And David Ignatius, he's columnist for The Washington Post, co-moderator of Post Global on Washington Post. com. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Nancy Youssef, the discredited presidential runoff election is underway in Zimbabwe. We understand that marshals are actually taking voters to the polls.
Yes, well, it's an extraordinary turn of events when you think about the last election and how heralded that was and where we are today. There had been a great hope that these elections wouldn't be held, that they would be postponed. The opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, has not participated. It's essentially a one-man election. They are being held now. Voters are being taken to the polling centers. There's talk that residents will be inspected to see if they have the ink on the finger to show that they voted. Tsvangirai has come out and said that the residents should not risk their lives. They should vote even if they just put an X at both names. They should go to the polling station. They shouldn't put their lives in danger. So it's distressing that that a country that had been so celebrated at one point for where it was is at this point today. And I think as we move ahead, the real question will be how other African nations respond, in particular South Africa, and what Mugabe himself will do to reach out to the opposition. Will he be able to hold on to power or not? The next days ahead will be critical.
Dave.
You know, I find this spectacle in Zimbabwe really grotesque. You know, this is a situation in which, you know, first the opposition candidate Tsvangirai was reported to have won a significant victory, 48% to 43% in the March elections. Mugabe immediately set about overturning that in ways behind the scenes, attacking people who'd voted for the opposition. And there were stories this week about just the horrible violence that's been done in the countryside, the people killed, threatened, intimidated. And Tsvangirai himself has just receded. It's so painful to watch him, you know, essentially give up. Under this,
To take refuge because he feared for his life.
It's one of those situations, you know. I mean, when you see in the world, you know, bad people, you know, authoritarians, dictators, people who kill their political enemies, triumphing like this, intimidating the other side, it's painful.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sad spectacle. I think Tsvangirai has really, you know, done only what he could do. I think most people think he's behaved responsibly, and I mean, I agree with David. It's a terrible fiasco, terrible for Zimbabwe. You have an economy completely on the rocks, runaway inflation. But look, you know, Mugabe is 84 years old. You know, one of the last of the traditional big African big men. And at some point, you know, mortality will take its course.
Well, the African Union has a summit in Egypt on Monday, and Condoleezza Rice said she's going to bring up the issue of further sanctions against Zimbabwe in the UN Security Council. But what's to be done? Anything? Nancy?
Well, Mugabe's already boasted that he has a plane ready to go to Cairo to attend that conference because he will be the president of Zimbabwe. You know, it's interesting, and to me, this is becoming as much a measure of South African President Mbeki's ability to respond and defuse the situation. It's become almost as much about him as it has about Zimbabwe.
And
so
so far,
he has not been effective. Can he do more, or is it going to require Western intervention? We'll
see. Nancy Youssef, Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. We'll be right back. We were talking just before the break about the situation in Zimbabwe and the fact that, you know, here you've got South Africa's leader not being able to do anything or unwilling to do something. You've got the UN, you've got the United States. What is there to be done about Zimbabwe, David?
Well, I think that's precisely the question that this poses. On the discussion forum that you mentioned, Post Global, on WashingtonPost.com, we posted today a question about precisely this issue. The UN has rarely been as united. Russia and China have joined in the condemnation. They switched sides effectively on this issue. The world is united in saying this is a problem, but nobody knows what to do about it. It's a real test of, you know, what do international organizations do when something awful is happening?
Even when there's that kind of agreement that it's awful.
There's an agreement that it's terrible, but what's to be? It's like Darfur. What's happening? What's being done? And the world has not figured out answers to that.
I think has happened, you know, some months back with the Kenyan election, is one of the goals has to be to prevent genocide or killing on a much greater scale than you have now.
Indeed.
And again, waiting out the 84-year-old Mugabe.
All right, let's turn to Iraq, where the U.S. Government Accountability Office issued a report this week on progress in Iraq. It noted that only 10% of Iraq's security forces were able to operate without U.S. military assistance. Nancy Youssef, you are about to leave for Iraq, where you will be embedded with
the Iraqi security forces.
The Iraqi security forces, not the American security forces.
You know, I'm going because there's been this discussion we talk about in Washington, the Iraqi security forces are in the lead. What does that mean? And how do they carry out in the lead? And how much are they taking from the training that they're getting from U.S. Army and MIT team advisors, military advisors? What are they embracing? What are they rejecting? How nationalistic are they? How sectarian are they? How much do they follow orders? What do they do when logistics and things fail?
Why are they allowing a woman to be part of that unit?
Because I was pretty aggressive in asking, and I went through the Ministry of Defense so that it would be sort of sanctioned by their bosses. But it'll be interesting. I don't know how they're going to receive me, but we'll see in the days ahead.
Indeed. And what about the GAO report, David?
Essentially, the GAO report was calling into question some of the claims that have been made about the success of the surge. They were examining the surge, the timeline that was given by July 08, in theory, you were supposed to have met certain benchmarks, and the GAO was looking and saying, these haven't really been met. Nancy cited, you know, one of the most important, you know, the Pentagon had various rebuttals of this, but I think it was a sign that although we all note the general reduction in violence, there have been some positive developments. You know, to say we've totally turned a corner the way some administration officials sometimes do about Iraq, just the facts don't bear that out.
You know, I was at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, at the Counterinsurgency Center when this report came out, and one of the commanders there had the title of the report updated. Updated strategy needed and highlighted. And because come July, the surge forces will be gone and the new way forward ends, essentially. And yet there's no name or policy for what happens next. It's not very clear. And in a way, this is the most important time to have a strategy because it's not going to be traditional army facing a traditional battle. The U.S. Army will be advising Iraqi soldiers. It sort of calls for a more cerebral officer, and yet it's not very clear how those army officers are supposed to operate in this very new environment. Mm. So it's something the army's looking for.
Yeah, I mean, that was the biggest question the GAO report raised, was we need a new strategy for the end of the surge. The Pentagon is saying, no, we don't. And, you know, the likelihood is that this is going to be handed off to the next president, who is going to either look at the situation and say, well, you know, the transitioning to Iraqi security forces is going fairly well. And there was a Pentagon report that came out at the same time as the GAO report, and was sort of the glass half full versus the half empty report of the GAO, which said, look, you know, things are going pretty well. And yes, there's only 10% of Iraqi forces that can act independently, but a large number of them, up to 90%, can actually take the lead. And indeed, since, you know, the Basra operation, you have seen considerable evidence that the Iraqi military has evolved rather impressively, with the U.S. still acting as its air force. So the questions are really hanging out there. You know, how capable is this force?
I just would note, Diane, that there is some interesting thinking, discussion going on among the circle of General Petraeus's advisors about a post-surge strategy. I think there is a recognition. I quoted an Australian counterinsurgency expert, Lieutenant Colonel David Kilcullen, who helped design the surge doctrine, if you will. And I think he and others really have concluded that we have to get the numbers down next year, that the footprint of U.S. force in Iraq is too large. In some ways, it's becoming counterproductive. So there is a sense, and I think Petraeus probably shares this, that you need to take advantage of what gains the surge has provided so as to reduce the numbers there.
And it's been a violent week in Iraq. You had two insurgent bomb blasts striking pro-American Iraqi targets in Anbar and in Mosul, and police said at least 30 people killed, 80 wounded.
That's right. And the one in Anbar is, I think, particularly worrisome for those who watch Iraq, because it suggests that Al-Qaeda forces are trying to move back into Anbar, a once restive province that the American government and military now celebrates as a success story. The target was Iraqi officials who backed the U.S. strategy, and today was supposed to be the formal handover, which was an extraordinary accomplishment by anyone's measure, given where Anbar province was a year and a half ago. the U.S. military saying that's been delayed because of sandstorms, but that it happened on the day after this massive attack on, which, by the way, killed three Marines in addition to 20 Iraqis, is symbolically troublesome.
Yeah, I mean, the insurgents in al-Qaeda in Iraq have shown a remarkable ability going back to 2003 to spot, you know, the most vulnerable link in the chain, and this appears to be it. And
well, so, then that raises questions about the strength or weakness of al-Qaeda in Iraq, David.
The evidence that we have been seeing has been that al-Qaeda is on the run, and, you know, that their ability to regroup and stage these attacks to go to the heart of what we thought was, you know, really the stable area, Anbar, and begin killing people there again, shows just how tough they are. And, you know, there's a long road ahead. It doesn't take 140,000 U.S. troops to deal with that threat, I would just note.
But to pick up on what David was saying before, though, about David Petraeus. Now, Petraeus is coming in as the new commander of CENTCOM in the fall, which means his area is going to include now Pakistan and Afghanistan, which he's already begun to address in quiet talks with Pakistani officials. And the reason why this becomes so critical for him is there's a trade-off between Iraq and Pakistan. I think it's generally agreed that you probably need a couple of additional brigades in Afghanistan to really take control of the situation. Those are not available. That's going to put additional pressure on Petraeus to continue the drawdown beyond the pre-surge levels in Iraq to make things work better in Afghanistan. So that's going to be a very, very tough debate for him in the fall.
If I could just add, on the al-Qaeda attack, you know, I think when violence like that happens, given where the levels were up until now, it sort of raises the question, at what point does one say al-Qaeda's reconstituted itself? At what point is it no longer on the run? What is the metric? Is it one bombing? Is it three? What is the metric? And I think in the next weeks ahead, as we look at the violence in Iraq, there'll be an effort to sort of determine that. Is this a one-time aberration, or is this a sign that they're back in some form?
And President Bush met with Iraqi President Talabani on Wednesday. They're talking about the status of forces agreement. What's happening there, David?
Well, this is really the catch-22, if you will, for both sides, for the U.S., but also for Iraq. We're heading toward a deadline at year-end in which the legal authority for U.S. forces to operate there expires, and also the legal authority to continue to run prisons that hold 20,000 pretty tough, you know, Iraqi insurgents. What's going to happen to that? So there's been a lot of concern, and what's driving it increasingly is Iraqi political opposition to the kind of broad agreement the U.S. had hoped to get. That's politically unpopular in Iraq. Iraqis want their country back. The Iranians, I should note, have made this, you know, issue number one. All of their propaganda organs are saying, no agreement, no agreement. And so that's made it very tough for Iraqi politicians to support it.
But the U.S. has dropped several conditions, most notably immunity for security contractors.
Well, I think there's still a lot of discussion going on that, and really, you know, the July 31st was the deadline. It may now be extended beyond that. They may come up with an interim agreement because that is something, you know, the immunity for U.S. forces and U.S. contractors was what had been initially demanded. We're not quite sure how much the Americans have given up on that, but I don't think they've given up entirely on that point.
You know, what's interesting is the timing of this discussion. It puts Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki in a difficult position after he was able to say that he had had success in Basra and Sadr City. With this agreement, the U.S. is basically putting him in a position to answer the question, am I an Iraqi nationalist first or am I a puppet of the Americans, and put him in that position of having to decide and not really be able to move forward with the successes he had in Basra and Sadr City. I think it's why the president, Jalal Talabani, was here, to sort of play good cop and not put Maliki in the position of having to come here and look to the Iraqi people that he continues to be, in their eyes, a puppet.
And the Pentagon released a report on insurgent activity in Afghanistan. Tell me what that found, Michael Hirsch.
Well, it was punctuated by remarks that Defense Secretary Robert Gates made, you know, this week at a news conference, saying he was extremely worried about what they've carved out, which is, you know, a new safe haven area in the tribal regions, which, according to Gates, and this was, you know, pretty extraordinarily blunt criticism, I thought, of the new Pakistani government, that they have basically shied away from putting the pressure on. Now, the real critical problem there is that there appears to be this divide between the new Pakistani government, which, of course, was opposed to Musharraf, and the army, the military, under Ashfaq Kiani, the new army chief of staff, which continues to negotiate a deal with the Massoud tribal militants in that critical Fatah, area of Fatah. And so there's a sense that no one really is in charge, and there's a lot of concern among the Americans that in this vacuum, if you will, the Taliban and the Pakistani Taliban, as they call them, and Al Qaeda continue to grow stronger in that region.
It's, you know, Afghanistan, which people thought, well, that was the good war, that was the hopeful front. You know, Iraq might be tough, but gee, Afghanistan, we were going to get that one right. You know, that optimism is fading. What you're really seeing now, I think, is a war that in which the national boundary, Afghanistan and Pakistan, is dissolving. It's dissolving for the insurgency. You know, the report that was issued by the Afghan government, blaming the Pakistani intelligence service for an assassination attempt on President Karzai in the middle of Kabul. I mean, that's a pretty amazing accusation.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And I presume there's talk of troop increases for U.S. troop increases for Afghanistan?
That's right. I mean, right now, the U.S. has the NATO coalition presence in Afghanistan is one third of what it is in Iraq, and yet troop deaths are surpassing Iraq troop deaths for, it looks like, for now, the second month in a row. 25 U.S. troop deaths in Afghanistan in both countries, 39 overall in Afghanistan. I think what's interesting in looking at the violence is, to me, it says how little the coalition knows about what's happening in Afghanistan. 2 weeks ago, there was the prison break in Kandahar and then the village that was taken over a week later. And yet no one seemed to know the details of what's going on after the town was raided, after residents were fleeing, after flyers were being dropped onto the streets. The Americans, the Pentagon said that the Taliban move-in didn't really happen. And of course, on the ground, it said something different. To me, it said that that the terrain is so difficult and there's not enough forces there, that unless there's an overt violent attack, the coalition doesn't really know what's happening in these villages. So the Taliban can move in, burn crops, move people out of their homes stealthily because of the lack of troops there.
And moving on to The investigation on Sunday of a Syrian site by UN officials speculating that it was a secret nuclear-built reactor. What did they find, David?
Well, we don't know because they didn't make any conclusive report on their findings. They said that they'd like to go back. The deputy head of the IAEA announced after the visit was over that they'd like to go back. There was an interesting battle within Syria about whether to allow this team in. And finally, it was a judgment, yes, let's let inspectors come in. The U.S. has presented intelligence to Congress and to the media that's pretty damning, that shows, you know, purports to show construction of this nuclear reactor in secret, and then after it was bombed, a sort of desperate attempt to cover it up and build something in its place that would hide it. You know, the inspectors won't find evidence of radioactive material because that wasn't yet at the site, so that's a red herring. But, you know, in terms of findings, they want to go back, they want to look again, so we'll just have to wait and see.
You know, what strikes me is how silent Syria has been since the inspectors left. You would expect some sort of public campaign to say that they are being persecuted, that this isn't fair, that their actions are legitimate.
But aren't they trying to at least hold on to the tiny openings already made?
Well, I think it says how seriously they take this. And
yeah.
And the connective thread, as it's becoming common now in the region, is that Syria is suspected of working with Iran in terms of the nuclear weapons development. And that, of course, is provoking Israel to say this needs to be dealt with. So again, the Iranian thread continues through the region.
Yeah, I mean, the Israelis, ironically enough, may have done the Syrian Bashar Assad a big favor by obliterating most of the evidence. But, you know, pieces of the puzzle will continue to come together from, you know, another front that we've just been discussing with North Korea, which is allegedly a helper to the Syrians in building this facility. So the more they open up and cooperate, the more we may learn about that. But Assad is extremely concerned about this, about being even more isolated by a negative UN report than he already is.
And finally, what's the status of the ceasefire between Hamas and Israel, Nancy?
Well, it's a week-long truce that appears to be faltering. There have been four attacks since Tuesday, rockets being launched, and there's real concern that this deal that was just negotiated, that was tenuous from the beginning, is faltering. I think it says that despite efforts to negotiate with Hamas on Gaza, that they can't control all the splintering factions that are
there. So the question is, who launched the rockets, do we know?
Well, there have been two claims of responsibility, yeah. Islamic Jihad on the first one, groups that they claim that aren't with Hamas. Hamas has tried to bring them under control. Whether they can is unclear.
Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers. Short break. When we come back, your calls, your email. Stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe on the web at germany.info. From Miriam Muscarolis and Grant Abramson, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, announcing Kids Count, a state-by-state look at child well-being and juvenile justice reform at aecf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The American Film Institute has issued its list of the top 10 American films within 10 different genres. On the next Fresh Air, part two of our series on the making of some of those films, Martin Scorsese talks about directing Raging Bull, and Michael Imperioli talks about his role as the kid Joe Pesci shoots in Scorsese's film Goodfellas. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup, and it's time now to open the phones, first to Detroit, Michigan. Good morning, Tito. You're on the air.
Yes, Dan. Yes, my name is Tito. I'm from Zimbabwe. This Zimbabwe issue has not been given the prominence that it deserves. We need a force to go in and remove Mugabe. It is so unfortunate that the African Union and the SADC are very weak organs and cannot do anything to help the people of Zimbabwe. But a lot of people are dying, 100 people in the month of June alone. Several were tortured and displaced from their homes. I was personally there in May and witnessed that kind of killing. It is so terrible. but it doesn't get enough coverage.
Well, it has been on the front page of every newspaper I have seen. I'm sure from your point of view, Tito, it's not enough. The kind of killing that's going on, the kind of murderous behavior. I fully understand your anxiety, your anger. What is there to do, David?
That's what we've been talking about in the show, and that's the question we all ought to go away with after the show's over. I think, you know, we journalists, commentators need to think, what are the tools? What are the mechanisms? What should have been done in Rwanda, where I just was a month ago, that could have spared a million people who were killed? What should have been done in Darfur? What should we do now? I mean, unless people figure this out and get it right, a lot more people are going
to
die.
And to Niles, Michigan, Godfrey, same question, I gather. Godfrey, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go right ahead, sir.
Yes, I'm from Zimbabwe too, and I've got three solutions. One is Mbeki is not genuine. He's got this liberation mentality that he liberated South Africa, and Mugabe also liberated Zimbabwe, so the owners. So it's not genuine. So there need to be pressure on Mbeki. Why Mbeki? Because the majority of our goods come through South Africa. So if he shuts the border for a week, that's it for Mugabe. The second thing is this. There was a travel ban on the ruling party members and also financial. If they can ban their families from traveling abroad and acquiring property, that would also help, but they don't follow through. Mugabe is in America as he pleases. He was even on the Rome convention.
All right.
The last thing is this. The last point I want to make is, like, you need to get Russia and China fully on board. There are some activities that they are doing, these two countries.
Thanks for your call, Nancy.
Well, he raises a lot of interesting
pressure
ideas.
Pressure on Mbeki.
But who puts the pressure on? Who does that? And that, I think that's why we're kind of coming around to this question of what to do. In a way, we're also asking who should do it and who has the authority to do it and who can do it effectively.
And how would Mbeki respond?
Well, so far, Mbeki has responded essentially by sitting on his hands.
He just hasn't
moved.
What about the travel ban on ruling party members, Michael?
That could definitely be somewhat effective. I think it's probably.
But who puts the ban there and who enforces
it? Well, obviously the U.S. has to take the lead here, and we need to see, you know, more activism from the State Department on that.
But that could make a difference. I mean, you know, there is a way in which the leadership in Zimbabwe is a criminal gang. They're profiting personally from this regime. What we saw with North Korea is if you go after the goodies that the ruling elite gets, and that was part of what the U.S. did when it was really trying to apply sanctions to North Korea, it has an effect.
And what about Russia and China? How do they play into this?
They have come around at the UN, but the issue is what next? But in terms of supporting it on paper, they're already there.
Godfrey, thanks for your call to Hollywood, Florida. Good morning, Jenny.
Good morning. I have a thing apropos to Africa also, and the only place I've heard anything mentioned about it was on the BBC, not on national news, period. There was an attack a couple of days before McCain started saying we should be doing offshore drilling. There was a terrorist attack on a Shell Oil off-rig 75 miles off the coast of Nigeria, a terrorist takeover. Nobody has said anything about this. It's been hush-hush, you know, and supposedly the group that's behind this is kind of really excited to be fulfilling al-Qaeda's dreams of interrupting U.S. oil supply. But my real issue is, this is something, especially if we're going to talk about offshore drilling, that NBC had a thing last night about what life is like on a drilling rig. Nobody in the press has mentioned this.
Nancy?
Well, I don't know about that specific case, but I know in terms of oil in Iraq, that has been a big issue, insurgents and militias profiteering from stealing oil. And so that's the most notable example that I know. But Jenny makes the point at an interesting time when we're talking about a barrel now $142.
Here's an email from David in Ann Arbor, Michigan, who says, Is it hypocritical for Bush to negotiate with North Korea and lift restrictions while at the same time criticizing Obama for being willing to talk with Iran or Palestine with quotes of appeasing terrorists? Michael.
Well, yeah. I mean, you could certainly put that interpretation on it. In his speech before the Israeli Knesset, Bush basically likened negotiating with enemies to what Neville Chamberlain did in 1938 at Munich. And here he has taken on and engaged a dictator that he himself has described as one of the worst in the world, and in fact made more concessions than Kim Jong-il has made. So I would say that was a fairly, pretty fair description.
Here's an email from Peter in Fern Park, Florida. How long was the Soviet Union in Afghanistan? 10 years? We know that outcome. What makes this administration believe they will have a different one, David?
Well, that's a haunting parallel. Osama bin Laden has said, he said in 2004, that his strategy was to lure us deeper into conflict in as many places as he could, in the expectation that we would end up exhausted and bankrupt as the Soviets were in Afghanistan and would leave. Having been there twice this year, I do think that, we should note that there are parts of the country where there is some progress being made. There is more security than there was. I think everybody looking at Afghanistan thinks we're likely to have significantly more U.S. troops there next year, whoever is president.
I was talking to an Army colonel at Leavenworth, and he said, it's not that Afghanistan isn't winnable, it's that we haven't really tried yet, that it hasn't taken...
But where are the troops going to come from?
That's exactly the problem. Now the discussion has been that as Iraq troops come down, more will go to Afghanistan. There was even a proposal at one point that that Afghanistan would be the Marine problem and Iraq would be the Army problem. So there's an effort to find the troops, but remember, this is a military that is exhausted from the Iraq war, and it needs a lot more troops, frankly, than even in Iraq now.
I mean, they're going to probably have to be American. Obama has said for some months now he wants to send two additional brigades there. Joe Biden has said the same thing. The outgoing commander of U.S. troops, Dan McNeil, basically said something very similar. I have heard through my sources that Petraeus is even considering something along the same lines. But because the NATO countries aren't really putting up additional troops, you've got a few additional from the French, but not many more, it's going to have to come from our already exhausted military, and that's going to be the trade-off with Iraq.
Well, what worries me is, personally, is it going to be in time? We're starting to see more sophisticated IEDs. These are the ones that are killing the coalition troops there. Can the coalition get enough troops in time, even as they're getting more sophisticated? Which will come first?
Let's go now to New York City. Good morning, Cameron.
Hi, thank you very much.
Sure.
My question is, again, going back to Iraq. I was wondering just how connected the insurgency or the fight against really American forces is connected to other issues, the overall Middle Eastern, problem or conflict. And is it really truly connected to Syria, Pakistan, Iran in a really, really concrete manner? Or is it just like the ideas are crossing the borders, but the people in Iraq who are really taking these up and fighting against us? I mean, is it more them or is it more us?
David.
Well, I think it's both and, not either or. I think, there are many different strands of the Iraqi resistance, the Iraqi insurgency. There's a part that's strongly backed by Iran, which wants to have a decisive role in the future of that country. There's a Sunni resistance that's been linked with al-Qaeda. We've, managed to put some distance between the two and have been able to bring many of the tribal leaders in Sunni areas over to our side. The larger background in the Middle East, the lack of a solution to the Palestinian problem, the kind of open wounds that stretch from Lebanon all the way to Iran. I mean, those problems, unfortunately, really are increasingly linked. They're all tied together in this really tight knot. And where do you break that knot? How do you begin to get out of it? And that's the real dilemma the next president faces is how on earth do we approach this cluster of problems and begin to make some headway?
Here's an email from Phil in Frederick, Maryland, who says, for the psychological warfare interest, How much does the Defense Department know about the origins of these bombers? In other words, how do they know they are tried and true hardcore terrorists or extremists instead of perhaps people who've been kidnapped for some negotiation outcome of that? They agree under force to be strapped up with explosives to comply with the deal if there is one. If that could be shown as the tactic, it would seem it might be able to be used by the coalition against the terrorists as a way of dealing with other human beings. Nancy.
Well, I think Phil gets at an interesting point, what's driving insurgents and militias. And I think the way to think of it, it's not once someone is an insurgent, they are for life. People come in and out of that sort of world. Most notably, the Sons of Iraq. So many members of the Sons of Iraq were attacking coalition and U.S. forces weeks before they were taking American money and working alongside them. It's not once an insurgent stays an insurgent or vice versa. It's a very fluid process. And some people do it for economic reasons. Mm-hmm. Some do it for ideological. But I think what's hard for the U.S. military is identifying someone, because as they've seen, someone who is an insurgent today could be an ally tomorrow. And I think that's where the real focus is turning that person around and making them a long-term ally and giving them a better incentive to work alongside them than to attack them.
David.
There have been reports periodically over the last several years about particular cases. You know, somebody appeared to have been handcuffed to the wheels of the steering wheel of a suicide car bomb, the use of people who seem to have mental difficulties, mental retardation as suicide bombers. But I think we're kidding ourselves if we think that's what's causing this, you know, the manipulation, chaining people. I mean, unfortunately, there is a supply of people who are willing to kill themselves. In Iraq, where there was not a tradition of suicide bombing, people used to say Iraqis wouldn't do that. You have women increasingly who are prepared to do this. Many of the bombers are women, and the idea that they're being forced, drugged, I don't think that's right. I think they want that. They believe passionately in this.
And it's undeniable that there's been a cross-pollination of suicide bombing tactics from Iraq to Afghanistan. One of the reasons for these terrible figures on American casualties there recently has been that this tactic has been adopted wholesale there.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email from Diane, who says, the U.S. military is citing an impending sandstorm as the reason for delaying the handover of power in Al-Anbar province. The Iraqi authorities are saying the delay is in deference to victims of yesterday's suicide bombing, which is true.
Probably both and neither, right? I think it's, look, that bombing yesterday was significant. Besides three U.S. Marines, it was a symbolic victory, frankly, for al-Qaeda, an undeniable sign that they were making a move back into Anbar. And I think the Iraqis are right. I think locally it would be seen inappropriate to hand over provincial Iraqi control to Anbar when their leaders, the ones who drove some of this change in Anbar, were killed just the day before. There is a 24-hour mourning period, and I think they're both true. And frankly, the sandstorms, having lived through some of them, logistically do make things more difficult. But realistically, yesterday's bombing what was the driving factor.
Here's an email from Andrew in Hallandale Beach, Florida. I suppose we're all supposed to know this already, but what is it that motivates Mugabe and his henchmen to terrorize, torture, harass, and destroy the lives of the entire nation of Zimbabwe? Please explain, what is the lifestyle of Mugabe and his followers, generals, and henchmen that motivates them to do absolutely anything to maintain his power and the power structure in Zimbabwe? Michael.
I mean, who knows what's inside Mugabe's head? I mean, I likened him to a traditional African big man earlier. I mean, he's utterly corrupt. He's grown used to power for 28 years. And when he saw the results of the March 29th election, which he lost to Morgan Tsvangirai, he just decided to act as he always had, which was to seize power once again.
David.
You know, why does an 84-year-old hold on to power? He could go to the Cap d'Antibes and you know, enjoy his ill-gotten loots. You know, what is that thing that the hand just doesn't let go? It's a human mystery. He is a person who came out of the liberation struggles having, you know, defied Britain, which was the colonial power there. The Brits tried very hard to keep him from power, and I think he has a much harder, rougher, tougher edge, in part because of that experience.
And finally, Sharon says, on The Daily Show this week, the editor of The Times of London said, there are only two people in the world who have the moral authority to intervene in Zimbabwe right now. They are Nelson Mandela and Barack Obama. Would you agree with that, Nancy?
Well, Nelson Mandela has spoken up in very strong terms, saying this has to end. Now, will it be in Barack Obama's power? We'll have to see. But it's been a difficult struggle so far, and whoever takes it on has an incredible task ahead of them.
Nancy Youssef, she's Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, about to head off to Iraq to be embedded with Iraqi security. Michael Hirsch of Newsweek, David Ignatius of The Washington Post. Safe travels, Nancy.
Thank you.
And have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.